Having this opportunity to reflect and write about my own process of aging has helped me go deeper, and I'm grateful. I had the opportunity to wonder, what's the opposite of aging mindfully? Jeff Warren, a meditation teacher I follow, says, when we run away from our discomfort, run away from our own suffering, this is an act of aggression against ourselves. The opposite of offering ourselves kindness, acceptance, and compassion. For me and many others, aging has brought challenges, changes both welcomed and unwelcomed, and losses of dear relationships, of our body's stamina, of our memories, of former roles and identities we held. And we could be running away from these uncomfortable places by choosing things like hating ourselves because of how we now look and feel, or by deepening a habit of reacting from our fears, which then can cause unnecessary misery for ourselves and others. Well, there's nothing wrong with taking care of our bodies and trying to look attractive, and nothing wrong with taking time to feel good about how we are. But our culture's deification of looking and acting young, of placing so much importance on that value, implies that when we're looking or feeling old, that something must be wrong with us, that somehow we aren't keeping up and not doing or being what we should be. But there are other paradigms, more healthy paradigms, for how we can travel through this last phase of our lives. Choices that can help us move into a new role of being awakened elders for our communities. Life threw me a helpline when I ran into an organization called Saging International a few years back, coincidentally at the same time that I could no longer ignore the fact that I too was now a senior. And just like those times in my life when I joined the Girl Scouts, for example, to build skills and get new friends, or joined my UU church for support in my spiritual growth, or when I joined the Mom and Me playgroup for help with learning how to be a new mom, I knew I wanted to be part of a learning, supportive community to help me with the challenges of aging. I don't want to be doing this alone. And it feels fabulous to be sharing, learning, and doing the inner work with people on the same leg of the trip. I've already seen some results of this intentional work, which I call spiritual work, since the work has opened me up beyond labels and has deepened my sense of connection with all. Changes such as the smaller physical changes that I've experienced show how concretely I've grown into accepting who I am. I've stopped dyeing my hair, and that brought new freedom and a deeper acceptance of myself. I stopped caring so much about my weight, and I have body image issues, so that was a big deal. And I said goodbye to clothing that no longer feels right, clothing that demands too much of me in order to wear it. I want my clothing and my life to reflect what I'm growing into, this new ease, a more graceful style, and simplicity. And then there are the larger inside changes. This spiritual work of conscious eldering has helped me not waste so much time procrastinating. Instead, I'm moving more quickly to do the things I've prioritized as being important for my values. I'm starting a master's program for social work this fall. I recently let go of a few relationships that I've realized are not good for me. I've also claimed other relationships in a more intentional way, and I spend time now thinking how I might make their lives more wonderful. For example, I'm looking forward to helping the mother of my adopted grandchild start her first Roth IRA and plan on surprising her by seed funding it. I'm also working with my dad to publish his autobiography, which has brought unexpected healing and connections between us. Doing this inner work of conscious eldering has also let me step up more often to do the bold things I wouldn't have dared to do in my youth. For example, sharing my vulnerabilities to a crowd of people. And most importantly, this work has invited me again and again to be with the uncomfortable, sometimes painful places, and to slowly and kindly gentle that scared part of me who would rather run. Learning to stay present longer has uncovered a treasure of nuanced and exquisite understandings about myself and others, and a new confidence in my gifts and ministry, which grounds the dailiness of my life. Saging International calls this inner work of becoming an elder saging. They say that saging is a spiritual practice that involves harvesting the wisdom of our lives and finding ways to transmit that wisdom as a legacy to future generations. And the details of this spiritual work? Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalami, in his seminal book, Aging to Saging, says that developing a spiritual practice for becoming an elder involves the following 7 components: examining our attitudes and fears about aging, and then practicing a new paradigm; connecting to our inner wisdom through the growth techniques of psychology and spirituality, which include meditation, contemplation, journaling, and spiritual intimacy; learning to nourish ourselves physically, emotionally, spiritually, socially, and mentally; examining our past through a life review process and life repair exercises; gaining an understanding that forgiveness is a gift we give ourselves; and identifying ways to serve as mentors and healers for our community, as well as learning to face our mortality with courage and serenity. I hear from my saging friends that there are even more payoffs ahead for the inner work that I and others are doing, and I'm counting on it. One of my favorite blogs recently is Carol Orsburn's Fierce with Age. She has a great quote that I want to end with here, excerpted from Florida Scott Maxwell's book, The Measure of My Days. My 70s were interesting and fairly serene, but my 80s are passionate. I grow more intense as I age. Though drab outside, wreckage to the eye, inside we flame with a wild life that is almost incommunicable. It has to be accepted as passionate life, perhaps the life I never lived, never guessed I had it in me to live. It feels other and more than that. It feels like the far side of precept and aim. It is just life, the natural intensity of life. And when old, we have it for our reward in doing. It can, at moments, feel as though we had it for our glory. Some of it must go beyond good and bad, for at times, though comes rarely, unexpectedly, it's a swelling clarity as though all was resolved. We who are old know that age is more than a disability. It is an intense and varied experience, almost beyond our capacity at times, but something to be carried high. Blessed be.
As I mentioned earlier in the service, I preached on this same topic last August. It does seem like a fitting topic for the Sunday when about 25% of our congregation is away on a camping trip. I don't know about you, but I feel my age when I consider sleeping on the ground. Of course, I am a year older, almost a year older than I was the last time I preached on this topic. And my parents, who were featured in last year's sermon and will be featured again this year, have had their own adventures to help me further contemplate aging. So here I am with Spirituality of Aging Part 2. As with any sermon that I write, once I start working on it, it seems like some filter falls away from my eyes and relevant things just flood into my awareness. So, for example, yesterday morning, this item came in on my Facebook feed, a list of 19 tips for healthy aging. 19. Apparently, this list is really for people young enough to remember 19 items. Now, there is some good stuff here. I'm likely going to post this on my refrigerator right next to the list I have of the 5 things that people say on their deathbeds. That list comes from a hospice nurse. I find that awareness of death brings life into sharper focus. Now, surprisingly, there's nothing on this list of 19 items that suggests you that you should develop a healthy relationship with death. For me, having the 5 deathbed items and looking at that when I open the door for the milk is my way of developing a healthy relationship with death. Perhaps having these 2 next to each other will help me pay more attention to the 19 ways of aging well. We'll see how that goes. Maybe next year I'll tell you about it. As I look at this list, most of the items on it would be relevant to any stage of life. Be healthy, don't be stingy, let go of the little things, be proud, keep your love alive. This is good advice at any age. But 19 items seems like a bit too much, and I'm a process person. What's helpful for me is more information on the process of aging. One of the best articles that I read for this sermon was by Lynn Huber, a gerontologist and spiritual director, titled Aging as Pilgrimage: Spiritual Potentials in Late Life. I like this so much that I'm going to put a copy of this essay on our website in case any of you would like to read it. Huber theorizes that humans approach each stage of our aging process with the same 3 questions. Who am I? What will I do? And with whom will I do it? So let's try this out in the life cycle. Obviously, in childhood, our parents and guardians set the boundaries for how we go about answering these questions. But as we develop independence, we make our own choices and can answer these questions in our own way. For example, an adolescent looking at options for going to college or whether to go to college at all would be asking, who am I? What will I do? With whom will I do it? I think, in fact, the question, who am I, is the essential question of adolescence. In early adulthood, these questions are critical. Career, relationships, friends. Who am I? What will I do? With whom will I do it? During the first half of our life, these questions help us define who we are as we work on building our ego, creating ourself, trying to become someone. At midlife, these three questions can take a turn as we recognize that we have less of our life ahead of us than we do behind us. Our culture likes to minimize this process and make jokes about the midlife crisis. You all know about the fellow who buys the sports car or the woman who gets a younger lover. We diminish the process when we define it this way. Neither the woman with the younger lover or the fellow with the sports car are handling their midlife crisis well, at least not by outward appearances. Midlife can be a time of profound spiritual potential as we sort out where we have been and what we see going forward. Who am I? What will I do? With whom will I do it? At midlife, we are forced to take our mortality more seriously, and it can be quite challenging to our ego. The author Huber proposes that the ego that is developed up until we reach midlife is more of a false self. False in the sense that it is based on outward recognition, outward valuation, our looks, our jobs, our connections, our money. She proposes that midlife is the transition point between the development of this false self, this outward self, and the birth of the true self. She says that midlife is a time of confrontation with the likelihood that the dreams of greatness that we may have had as a young person will probably not be fulfilled. We have insufficient time, not enough resources, not enough of anything. In fact, we are not enough because we must confront and accept our finitude and ultimately our mortality. My midlife crisis was big and transformational. In my late 40s, a couple of my work colleagues died of cancer. They were a few years older than me, but not that much. It was a real wake-up call. Suddenly, I was acutely aware of that quality of midlife when the days ahead are shorter than the time that you've lived. I loved my job. I was respected and rewarded for the work that I did, but as I looked ahead, as I projected my life ahead, I knew that the job was not going to sustain me for another 20 years. It was 10 years ago this month that I quit my job and applied to seminary. I had felt the call to ministry for years, but finally, at that midlife point, I had the courage to take the leap. Answering those questions of who am I, what will I do, and with whom will I do it, transformed my life and brought me here today with you. Now, after 5 years of ministry, I find myself asking a fourth question as I look ahead to the rest of my life, a deeply spiritual question. What do I hope for? As I look ahead to my years remaining, what do I hope for? This question has also been on my mind because of a major transition in my parents' lives. At the ages of 90 and 92, my parents have left their life of complete independence in their own home, driving their own car, doing all their own cooking and cleaning, totally taking care of themselves. And they've moved to a senior residence where everything is taken care of for them. It's taken 2 years of discussions, one major fall for each of them, and lots of time and processing for them to make this decision. They have also moved farther south to be closer to my sister, her children, and their 7 great-grandchildren. So it means a new city, new doctors, new everything. They downsized by about 50%. My parents have given me an up-close and personal view of late-life development. I see them asking these questions in their new frame of reference, in their almost stunned place that they are right now. Who am I? What will I do? With whom will I do it? But what I really want is for them to be asking the question, what do I hope for? Many experts on aging that I've read agree that the elder years are not a shutting down of self, but a profound time of transformation and growth. And Kate's remarks reflected a lot on this. No one's trying to minimize the challenges of aging, but rather to acknowledge that it can be a time of significant personal and spiritual growth, a time when maintaining hope and a positive sense is critical to well-being. What can you hope for in your elder years? What personal growth can you strive for? How can you keep hope active in your life? I think one of the things that's worth hoping for is the idea of peace within yourself, the acceptance of who you are, and less concern about what people think. It is the spiritual challenge of the journey from the false self to the true self. And the elder years is the time when this true self shines. As Mae Sarton says, becoming who you were meant to be. I've been carrying this aphorism with me for a long time. It says, when you're young, you worry about what other people think about you. But at midlife, you say, I'm not going to worry about those people anymore. I'm going to do what I want. But in your later life, you finally realize that no one was really thinking about you anyway. They were too worried about what you were thinking about them. In old age, we can opt out of this game completely and be who we are. It's a time for authenticity and letting go of the demands of maintaining this false self. Who am I is a question that's answered by looking within rather than looking without. As we age, we can hope for connection. Many elders become isolated as they age. It is easy to let your world get smaller and smaller as life gets more difficult to navigate. I have seen this happen with my parents. All of you here are way ahead of that game because you are here. You are here in community. What will I do? Whom will I do it with? We hope for connection in our elder years. We can hope for peace of mind, that we can finally let go of resentment of others, grudges, things that you've held on, the litany of wrongs that many of us carry in our hearts. In our later years, we can hope for a sense of legacy. Maybe that's something we all hope for, that our lives have not been meaningless. This sense of legacy, I believe, requires us to see ourselves as part of something larger than ourselves, a family or a community or a movement. I see this legacy issue in my parents as they downsize. Who will take the pine hutch? It's been in our family for 70 years. Who will take Grandpa's desk? That's the desk where he wrote all his letters. What will become of all the items that we have held so dear for all these years? But we know that material items are just symbols of the bigger issues of legacy. How will we be remembered? How have we influenced the lives of those close to us? These developmental questions are critical in our elder years. And I like to believe in our elder years that we can hope for a good death. Now, of course, what makes a good death depends on the person. I want to say that I think the book Being Mortal by Atul Gawande should be required reading for everyone who will eventually die. Everyone. The author tells us that having a good death requires a good relationship with death itself. My 92-year-old father is working on that relationship, fluctuating between his desire not to live anymore, no one should live this long, he says to me, and his fear of dying, his awareness of his death. This is good, important work. He and I have had many, many emergency room trips in the last 5 years, and as the doctors try to keep his failing body functioning, after each visit, when we're on our way home, he would turn to me and say, I guess this is not what's going to kill me. The last time we were in the emergency room, the doctor told him that his heart was failing and there wasn't a lot that they could do for him. We looked at each other and said, he said to me, we know what's going to kill me. We just don't know when. What is a good death? Is it freedom from pain, family surrounding you? A good death is whatever it means to you, but you must have a conversation with your loved ones to have a chance at that good death. My parents and I sat down with a document called The Five Wishes, which goes over all your wishes for end of life, all the ways you'd like to be treated in the hospital, in the family, what you'd like for your memorial. It lays out all the things and gives your family a clear sense of what a good death means to you. But of course, it's not really that simple. There's so many things that we don't have control over. Many of us may face illnesses that require multiple decisions about treatment, complicated, difficult decisions. The Being Mortal author tells us that the fundamental question in the last stage of life is whether fear or hope will rule the day. Fear or hope. Which one will be the driving force in your final years? Choosing hope requires confronting your mortality, accepting that there are things that you will never know, such as when you will die, and what will happen to you after you die. You must make peace with this mortality as best you can. Last year at the aging service, Marilyn Reynolds gave a reflection and shared this wonderful statement. She said, I like life, and I hope I've got several good years left. But whether it's years or months or days, I trust that the universe is well-ordered and benign, and that whatever does or does not come after this life is nothing to fear. Making peace with death. I have focused on hope in consideration of the latter years of life, but I have to say, hope is not a passive activity. I've preached on hope before. Hope is more like a muscle that you need to develop throughout your life. It's not sitting there waiting for something to float by that you can just take in. You don't want this hope muscle to atrophy because you want to have it during those last days of your life. You have to choose hope at all stages. Choose to stay alive and be engaged. Choose to stay engaged in your own growth and development, even in the dying process. Not everyone will have a good death or even good elder years. Some people will get stuck in trauma or pain. Some people don't have the inner resources to stay with the questions and will end their lives living in fear rather than in hope. I have been watching my parents transition with trepidation as to their future, fear or hope. Despite my best efforts to help them, their move did not go well. The packing and the unpacking was miserable, and there was a mix-up with their apartment, and they had to change apartments a week after they moved. It's taken more than a month for them to finally get settled. They miss their old life. They miss their old home. And it seems that every time I spoke to them, there was a litany of misery. The food was cold at lunch. The telephone wasn't working. The laundry is not done properly. The shower water is too hot. I didn't want to call them anymore because I couldn't deal with their misery. I want them to find some hope that this would be a good place for them, that they made the right choice to move. I want them to have a good elderhood. But I can't make them choose hope over fear. I can pray for them, I can love them, but I can't make them choose hope. I spoke with my father yesterday morning, and for the first time in 2 months, he had something good to say. Something good had happened. Lunch was delicious. Yay for lunch being delicious! And they had a wonderful visit with family and two of their great-grandkids. He told me my mother remembered how she'd played with her grandson when he was a baby, and now she was playing with his son. Her great-grandson. Yes, I thought, this is why they went through all that. This is why they made the move. I suggested to my father that perhaps the clouds of misery had lifted enough so that they could hold out the possibility of hope, the possibility of happiness. These were my exact words to him, clouds of misery and all. My father laughed. He said, maybe. Maybe so. Blessed be.